Live from New York City, it's The Gary Noel Show. And now, your host, Gary Noel.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Noel. This is going to be one extremely packed program. I'm going to give as much time as I can to our special guest, Professor Boyle. We're going to go into the topic of understanding how we end up with regime changes, and he is an expert on international law, so he's going to talk about that. And then I'm going to play a couple audio clips from you so that you can tell us over our voice line what's on your mind. I'll try to address them as best we can. I'm going to give you the latest on health and healing as well. We've completed another round of commentaries, investigative reports. Well, tomorrow we start another one. We're going to look at a very important issue, and that is death by medicine. And this is a continuation of articles. Then on the last day of this week, we're going to present a detailed description, and we're going to post it for you to be able to share with many of the legislators who support universal health care, because it shows you how to fund it. This is the scholarship that's been lacking in the political discourse. So, as you see, we're doing a lot. I want to start today, before I go to health and nutrition, just a brief mention that there are 25 Democrats who voted to make boycotting a crime. Yes, that's correct. And unfortunately, these are people who are generally embraced by the corporate Democratic and corporate liberal establishment. Not true liberals by any means. Certainly not by the Marxists, by the socialists. But these are the people who get elected time and again. For example, in New York, we have Charles Schumer. And in close by, in other states, such as in New Jersey, we have Mendez. And out in Washington, we have Murray, Hansen, Duxworth, Cortez Masto in Nevada. We have Casey in Pennsylvania. So we have all these Democrats, Blumenthal in Connecticut. Historically, the Democrats were supposed to have been for freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, freedom to protest. But now those very same values are being eroded by people who have either an ideological or political or financial interest. Have they become nothing more than corporate shills? Who's paying them? And boycotting what? This is about boycotting Israel. We give Israel $10 million a day, every day, minimum. And yet here in this country, we say we can't afford to fund public education, school teachers, universal health care, or help those who are homeless. What does that say about these Democrats? From the Republicans, I would expect this. From the Democrats, well, they show us they're really, these Democrats at least, are no different than the Republicans. Just want to share that with you because we have to understand that Israel now has more power against our legislators than any single other group in the United States. That is not cool. But that's what it is, and until we change it, we can change it. And we're going to be doing a series of articles, investigative reports, exposing who gets how much money from which groups, and then how do they vote. In fact, last year I did exactly that. In the state of California, I showed all the legislators voting for mandatory vaccines, headed by a medical doctor who got the most money, and they got the money from vaccine makers. That should have disqualified them. That should have been a scandal that the Los Angeles Times should have talked about. Not a word. As a result, now it's mandatory. I know people have actually moved out of California and gone up to Oregon or Washington or other places. Oregon's not a good place to be because Oregon is even more radicalized on vaccines. They're now proposing that any person who has a baby in the state of Oregon must have a minimum of 3 home visits mandatory. where they make sure your baby gets all of its vaccines, no matter how many that is, no matter what the condition of the baby, is irrelevant. And that if you choose not to vaccinate for any reason, watch Child's Protective Services be there to charge you with being an unfit or parent or a danger to your child. So much for Oregon. So much for California. So much for the people who allowed this to happen. So much for the legislators. So much for the journalists who are in the back pocket, or they're either brain dead, stupid by intent, or they're compromised, or they don't care. Pick your choice. It comes out to the same. The American media is complicit in everything that's wrong in the world today. And you talk with them, and they tell you another story. So we begin with the latest on health and healing. And the latest on health and healing starts with a story out of the University of Leeds, which is in the United Kingdom. And it talks about fruits and vegetables are very important for our mental as well as physical well-being. And this is over a period of time. And the study also controlled for alternative factors that impact a person's mental well-being, such as your age and education and your income and marital status and employment status and lifestyle and health, as well as consumption of other foods like bread and dairy products. So they looked at a lot of different factors to see how you're living a longer life. And the research showed a positive association between living a longer quality of life and how many fruits and vegetables you consumed. Specifically, the findings indicate that eating just one extra portion of fruits and vegetables a day could have an equivalent effect on mental well-being as about 8 extra days of walking a month. That's something. So think about those of us that are consuming 13, 14 servings of fruits and vegetables a day. Some of us even more. Higher fiber in the diet, more antioxidants, more polyphenols, more healing nutrients. That's important. And that's what we're showing. This study proved it. But many of you already know that. Think of the people now listening who don't look or feel the same as people you graduated with from high school, or even people in your own family. You don't need a scientific study to show you just common sense. From the University of Basel in Switzerland, published in Scientific Reports, even psychological placebos have an effect. A placebo has an effect, and does not only occur in medical treatment. Placebos can also work when psychological effects are attributed to them. Psychologists at University of Basel reported their findings in the journal based upon 3 studies of over 400 participants. The psychotherapy and placebos are both psychological interventions that not only have comparable effects, but that are also based upon a very similar mechanism. Both forms of treatment are heavily influenced by the relationship between patients and those treating them, and as well as expectations of recovery. And they can have a calming effect. Now, I'm going to take this to a larger ethical implication. I reported on a story of a priest that went in to give the last rites to a patient that was terminally ill in hospital, and the next day that patient died. And sometime later, much later, when the priest was back in there, he was told that the patient was waiting and found out that he had gone in to give the wrong person their final rites, and that person died. The person didn't get their last rites, was still alive. What does that tell us? The power of an expectation from an authority figure. Look at the positive effects. I mentioned yesterday, and possibly some people understood the full meaning, possibly others didn't, that we have desensitized ourselves to the things that are really important to many people. We're so immersed in identity politics and destroying Trump, and I do not support Trump. I do not support him on any level, nor the people around him, the John Boltons. Every single appointment he's made has been the wrong appointment, and he is the wrong person to be president. But so, too, would have been Hillary Clinton. Bernie Sanders would have been substantially better, but the best of all would have been Jill Stein. But that's a separate issue. The issue is that what's important for most Americans are things that they don't have a lot of control over, but others in power do. But if you don't make it an issue for people in power, they're not going to pay attention to you. And I mentioned some of the things such as the suffering, the abandonment, the loneliness, the desperation by people who are at the end of their life or senior citizens, and they've been forgotten and put aside by society. The 3.5 million children leaving school each day who have no home to go to. Could you imagine the psychological impact that has on them? Imagine all the single mothers who are struggling to make ends meet, who are living in impoverished conditions and trying to be a good mother, a good parent, to keep their children to appreciate the ethics that that person might have grown up with. They're all challenged. And yet, what are we doing to help them? What are we doing to help the real unemployed in this country, which are over 92 million people, over 22% of the American population, up to 28%? What are we doing to increase the quality of earning capacity and quality of life to people instead of minimum wage survival? Nothing. What are we doing to find homes for the homeless? Nothing. We make it a federal crime, as it should be, or a state crime, to abuse a dog or leave it outside in the cold. You can be arrested for that. And yet while you're driving to arrest someone who left a dog outside in the cold to freeze to death, which that person should be arrested and incarcerated, you'll drive right by streets loaded with homeless people freezing to death, as if there's no irony in that. Well, to me, there is an irony. We have police that are there to serve, but the Supreme Court says they do not have to protect or serve. They've been militarized. Hence, they look at us more often than not, not all by any means, though, as the other. We have laws that are passed that are just insane. And we've turned misdemeanors into crimes so we can fill our prison systems. Why isn't that being addressed? Why is the return of poverty at such a dire level that people can go now to debtors' prisons that were banned in 1822 or 23, around there? But they're back, and both Democrats and Republicans are supporting them. That's not an issue. It should be. Stopping all wars and regime changes should be important because the consequence could lead to armed conflict. Supporting the destruction of a country with 21 million people starving to death. That should be a concern, shouldn't it? Somewhere, to someone. Maybe one person in America actually gives a damn about the children dying in Yemen, but you wouldn't know that, would you? Because we don't see any protests. We don't see any Me Too movements. We don't see any Let's Do Something movements. We don't go on general strike to stop children from dying. But if a child dies in America, we're concerned. But it depends upon the child. Are they poor? Are they color? Are they white? Are they a rich person's kid, a Lindbergh kid? Then we pay attention. What hypocrisy. We're nothing if not completely hypocritical. And one of the things I mentioned is, before you challenge a person of faith, no matter what faith, ask yourself, how would you feel when your faith is one of the guiding principles in life that has given you meaning and comfort, when maybe other things have not? That's given you a sense of community and a sense of belonging, where you can go to a mosque, a synagogue, a church, a prayer meeting, and you can be with people where you're sharing some common moral standards. But we're not doing that, are we? We're mocking these people. We're ridiculing them as if somehow they're too stupid to be hip. And they're not a part of the solutions of life. They're part of the problems. Only when they become an atheist and renounce all this paganism what many atheists consider religion is just a opiate for the disillusioned. But what do you know about a person of faith? What do you know of the strength they have? Now go to the study today. What if your faith allowed you to stay moral or ethical or kind or care about your neighbors or care about how you speak with other people, treat other people? For those of us who grew up in communities, as I did, where your moral value was an extension of your character values. It doesn't feel good to be mocked and ridiculed for something that has helped you be the best you can be, especially to other people. As my mother told me during the Great Depression when she was working on our great aunt's farm, they would feed half of everything they had every day to strangers. They'd set up picnic tables by the railroad track in Little Hockin, Ohio, and whatever they had, they would make sandwiches, and the train could only stop for a minute or two because the conductor was thoughtful for the people who are hobos. And he'd let them off and say, "We got to go," and up over the Swiss, you get right back on, because he'd lose his job. Instead, they'd jump off the car and there'd be a table and they'd be handed food. And as my mother said, one time there was this guy who was combing his hair and he straightened his tie, and she turned to my aunt and she said, "Why is he doing this? We're in the country." And she said, "He may be poor." Yes, but he still has dignity. When you challenge someone in their moral values, you have no right to do that. You do not know the power that that person of faith has in their own life if they have nothing else, and what they value in other people's life because they're a person of faith. Now, you can take examples of any religion, and or most religions, that have had negative periods, wrong statements. Yes, absolutely. But you look at something at the best it can be or has been. So just remember this, listen carefully. What you believe in is your faith. And if your faith allows you to be a better person, to live a longer life, to make better choices, to interrelate with people in a more meaningful way, then it has served you well. And for anyone else to denigrate that, just remember, those are the silent majority, the ones that no one in New York or Los Angeles or Washington thinks have any value as human beings, because none of their real needs are ever served. But sooner or later, they will awaken, and in mass, they will protest against what becomes intolerable conditions, because they're always the first ones to suffer, when, especially if they're poor or middle class, when it comes to climate change, catastrophes, food shortages, extreme events, the decline of the American dollar as the reserve currency, and an utterly corrupt system of politics. Just a thought. Next up, zinc can protect against oxidative stress when it's taken together with chocolate and tea. This is from Frederick Alexander University, which is in Germany, plus the Auburn University. And this is published in Nature Chemistry. And it suggests that nutritional benefits of zinc can be very powerful when combined with a natural compound found in chocolate or tea. In particular, the study suggests that the trace mineral zinc can help activate an organic molecule that can prevent oxidative stress. Well, wow, that means that when you're taking your zinc and you're having some chocolate at the same time, you're slowing down the aging process. Now, superoxide dismutase is a byproduct of human cell respiration and a damage to the body's own biomolecules, like proteins and lipids and even human genomes. So this interferes in that process. It also turns off inflammation that leads to neurodegeneration diseases like Alzheimer's and cancer and MS. And so take your zinc, and remember, green tea and chocolate are helping you live a longer life. And finally, flaxseed fiber ferments in your gut to improve your health and reduce obesity. This University of Copenhagen published in the American Journal of Physiology, Endocrinology, and Metabolism. So flaxseed is generally not eaten by most people, but you should. You can get not flax seeds, I don't recommend them, but I recommend flaxseed fiber. That's where they've simply taken the whole flaxseed and they've just pulverized it. It makes it easier to digest. You're getting more availability out of it. So the more, I would say maybe 5 grams of flaxseed fiber in your diet could really help the bacteria in your intestines And then that, in turn, helps your whole system. And by the way, Penn State University just came up with a study. The cannabinoid compounds can inhibit the growth of colon cancer cells. So one more reason why medical marijuana in an enlightened society with enlightened politicians who are not on the take from the alcohol industry or big pharma, which they are, unfortunately, with rare exception, but medical marijuana with over 22,000 studies in our government's own PubMed has gained attention in recent years for its potential to relieve pain and short-term anxiety and depression. Now, Penn State College of Medicine researchers say some cannabinoid compounds can actually inhibit the growth of colon cancer cells in the lab. And this was published in the journal Cannabis and Cannabinoid Research. Good for them. Good research on that. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to take a break because we got a lot more to cover. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
My name is Martin. I attended one of your retreats, Mr. Nall, a while back. It was fantastic. I learned a lot. However, I didn't stick with the protocol. I worked for the sanitation department, and I drank coffee and believe that it's triggering migraines. Quick question, please. I work for a sanitation department and wake up about 4:30, some days, and I have a long commute, so I've been drinking coffee for the last 20 years. It's very hard to get off the coffee with the withdrawals. Is green tea better for inflammation and less migraines if I drink green tea instead of coffee? Or eliminate caffeine altogether. Or maybe decaf coffee, I don't know. Thank you very much.
Be happy to answer that. And it's a common question, and one that we should have a discussion on in America. I want to go back to a point I just made, though. I want to make it clear what I was saying. What I'm saying is that having faith in the things that you believe are important, a higher ideal, something that allows us to look at a higher level of standards for ourselves, frequently comes from people who believe in life, believe in love, believe in respect, believe in nature, believe in the sentient beings of animals and the love that animals can share with us. They're optimistic because they have belief. Beliefs can be positive or beliefs can be negative. But if we say that a belief is only a placebo, then we're denying the reality of any other energy exchange in life. That's a limitation of the intellect. It is not a limitation of reality. Remember, reality always, always, always supersedes scientific discovery on the human genome pattern. So we just discover things that were there all along, and then, wow, I didn't know this worked, I didn't know that worked. And prayer works. We've actually found that with good scientific studies that people didn't even know they were being prayed for and proved over a group of people cross-matched with other conditions. So I'm a big believer that having faith in being healthy, surviving, and one of the things I try to instill in every single person I counsel who's terminally ill is have faith that you will get better. And frequently these are people who have lost faith. They've gone to the dark side. They look at our systems of corruption. They look at venality. They look at greed. They look at hubris. They look at indifference. And they say, what can I have faith in? Look at Humanity Day. And for every time someone says I say, have you seen every person who's helped another human being? Have you seen the people? Did you see the woman that paid for the rent in the coldest night in Chicago's history so that a number of, I don't know the number, but I think it was 70 people So a woman, she's not a rich woman, but she paid for the rent in a hotel for 70 people. That is something that inspires you, that why can't we all come to a higher standard of ethics and morality in how we treat one another? Because when you're living at a high level of faith in the human condition, in people's potential, then at least you have a capacity to reach across a divide and no longer be separated by the differences, political differences, ideological difference, cultural differences. A farmer in Russia is no different than a farmer in Iowa. Get them together and they have so much in common. We should allow body politic to define who has value as a human being and who does not. So I believe very strongly faith keeps us human. To answer your question, coffee has a lot of caffeine in it, far more than green tea, about 90 plus milligrams in an 8-ounce cup compared to 35 milligrams if you get green tea. Thus, point one, coffee is more addictive. Green tea has an amino acid. It's called L-theanine, T-H-E-A-N-I-N-E. When you see N-I-N-E, that means you're dealing with amino acid. And that's been linked to improved alertness because it ramps up the calming neurotransmitter GABA, gamma-aminobutyric acid. And that decreases anxiety, so you're going to be more alert and less anxious with green tea. Theanine helps with productivity and focus, minus the jitters. Now, both coffee and green tea have a lot of polyphenols and anti-inflammatory agents and antioxidants, fairly equal. Now, green tea's benefits are that it has an anti-inflammatory called EGCG, which can suppress overproduction of cytokines and prevent the formation of plaques associated with brain lesions. So if I want to have a healthier brain, a cleaner brain, healthier arteries, cleaner arteries for blood flow to control my blood pressure, to control the oxygenation of my brain, I'd want green tea. Green tea protects your gums. And green tea reduces the risk of skin and breast and prostate cancers. Green tea reduces nausea and side effects of chemotherapy. Green tea has no headaches associated with it. And it's more frequent in other countries in the United States. Now, there was a study done. I don't know the date of the study, but it was about more or less 6,500 to 7,000 coffee versus tree drinkers, and found tree drinkers had less buildup of calcium in their arteries, arteriosclerosis. And the pros of coffee is a lot of studies show that for older adults, drinking a cup of coffee a day will help you if you have Alzheimer's, Parkinson's. And it has some antidepressant qualities, especially among women. That was a Harvard study. And it can help. It can destroy some precancerous skin cells. But remember, the key here is caffeine, because caffeine consumption and metabolism are influenced by genetic markers near the CYP1A2 and the AAHR genes. And the CYP1A2 is a gene which contains instructions for an enzyme that breaks down 95% of caffeine that you consume. And the AHR is a gene that contains instructions for protein that ramps up production of the CYP12 enzyme, which is involved in breaking down caffeine. And so that's important. But overall, my first doctoral thesis was on caffeinism. I did 2 years of lab work and a clinical study. And I determined that the best part of coffee is the green raw coffee bean, the organic green raw coffee bean that is not boiled, that is not processed into a coffee, but rather simply crushed and consumed for its polyphenolic activity, and therefore it's very beneficial for your metabolism. But green tea, hands down, they're not even in the same universe, would be the favorite. There are thousands and thousands of studies on green tea, and they're very beneficial. We're going to take a break and come right back. Please stay with us. By the way, if you'd like to call in and ask a question, please do. 24/7 you can call. We have a new voicemail line. Let me give you the number. Please write this down. I'll take it slow. 862-800-6805. 862-800-8605. And that way you can leave a voicemail and I'll address it. And then when I hear it, on whatever answer I can give you, I'll give you. Hopefully it'll be beneficial. But I'm only going to take one question on one topic. So if you hear me talking about breast cancer, then that's breast cancer. I want to try different questions every day so that you get a wide variety of conditions or issues, and I'll address all of them. I don't want to have I won't do 20 questions on Alzheimer's. I'll do one definitive one on it. So if you've heard me answer something, don't ask that question. Ask a different one. Okay? Now, we're going to go to our guest in about 7 minutes. And just so you know, my guest is quite simply one of the brightest people you're ever going to meet. He is Francis Boyle, B-O-Y-L-E, and he is professor of international law at the University of Illinois Law School. He has a long career as an anti-war activist and upholder of human rights. He has served as a counsel to Bosnia and other countries, as a legal advisor, also to the Palestinian delegation in the Middle East negotiations from 1991-93. He has served on the board of directors of Amnesty International and Council for Responsible Genetics, and he drafted the legislation for what became the Biological Weapons Anti-Terrorism Act of 1989, which was signed into law by the first Bush administration. So he has a long, distinguished history. And we're going to talk about the U.S. support for a coup in Venezuela and its international violations. So that'll be in a few minutes. But I just want to take a few moments here because we are in a new fund drive for our sister station in New York, WBAI. And because of that, we're counted upon to raise as much funds as we can reasonably do, and the way that we can raise the most amount of money, it requires the greatest effort, is by having a retreat. And this year we're having one retreat. It will be it will be in the last week of April, the first week of May. Beautiful time of year, by the way, where we're having it. There'll be thousands of flowers blooming. The environment is just spectacular. And once again, I will bring staff from all over the United States who will share their insights and energy from cooking classes and juicing classes and really deep counseling, excuse me, to some thought-provoking lectures that are intended to make us think, to exercising. And if you've only been there and seen what is humanly possible, and by no measure of scientific rationale can you describe this as being understandable. There are things in life that you cannot understand, but life was never meant to be fully understood. It was meant to be lived with joy and happiness and openness. And that's what a retreat is. The finest food, the best lectures, being close to nature, silent time, because with a silent mind we heal. And where people can start over. You can be dynamically healthy, and you even can take that to another level. Or you can be challenged with sickness, and you can realize all the options you have to come from that doom and gloom place to one of optimism and hope. So this is what we do at a retreat. And I'm going to give you Luann in a moment, Luann Panessi, who counsels everyone, but she also screens everyone to make sure it's right for you. And I just want to mention that we were able to pay for over 1,000 premiums. The station didn't have to pay a penny. And all those premiums were paid for by all of our efforts at the last retreat. But right now, I was just told, and I'm looking here, that we have Larry on the phone and Kathleen on the phone. And let's go first to Larry. Hi, Larry.
Hi, Gary.
Larry, tell us briefly what you experienced at your last retreat and why you came and what you've experienced using different protocols before with challenging conditions.
Okay, so I came to the retreat because I had a health crisis where my lymph nodes were suddenly, two of them were suddenly swollen. A PET scan showed them suspicious for cancer. I have had two other bouts with cancer and have warded them off through natural protocols based on what you know and what you've done. And while they've been quote-unquote successful, here I was again with another episode. And so I came to the retreat to find a way to heal and basically spent most of the week outside sitting, watching the trees, and reflecting. The food, of course, was incredible, gourmet vegan food like I've never had. And I've been eating close to vegan for many years, so... the people there, that the staff were incredible and just so helpful. What happened is that we would, you would give lectures spontaneously and scheduled throughout the day, which were very intense and thought-provoking. And they challenged everyone to really look at their lives and say, is the life I'm living the life that I'm supposed to be living? Or am I living some kind of life based on what I've been told I should be and what I should do by my parents and society, etc. So, I mean, it was really earth-shattering, and I came to the conclusion, actually, that no, I wasn't living an authentic life, that I'm an artistic spirit, and I was living a different kind of life, a business, hard-driving businessman, successful financially, in the top of my area, so I was successful, but I wasn't satisfied, and my body was breaking down and telling me, hey, you've got to pay attention. So as a result of it, of all this time reflecting and listening to you and considering my life, I came home and I said, I'm turning everything around. I'm giving up what's not authentic. I'm letting go of my business, and I'm living my life, who I am, as an artistic soul and a writer, and that's what I'm going to do. And so now I've been home and beginning on this new journey, which is certainly not simple and it's certainly not easy, but I know in my heart that it's the right thing, and I feel at peace with it, and I could feel my body changing and relaxing and letting go of the stress that I've been carrying with me for so many years.
Good for you. We look forward to seeing you again, Larry. Let's say hello to Kathleen. Hi, Kathleen.
Well, hi, Gary. How are you?
Good. Kathleen, tell us what you experienced and what you learned.
Oh, wow. Do you have 3 hours? basically, I was very involved in the personal development arena years ago, and, you know, you think that you know a lot about your human condition because, you know, we, those of us that take this journey with you, Gary, are passionate about how to make our lives more effective and to be the best we can be. We reach for that potential that we feel sometimes is not within our reach. And, you know, I mean, just to be in the presence of you, I mean, you are one of the era's great thinkers, and just to have your spontaneous discourses come forward, like Gary had mentioned, that give us you know, you come at it in a lot of different ways, because sometimes, you know, that conditioned mind is so stubborn and so impenetrable that you have the capacity to be able to speak things from different perspectives and do it with this kind of grace of a comic. You know, you're like a stand-up comic. You go into these little, you know, demonstrations of how the mind operates, and it, you know, humor helps a great deal to get through that very stubborn conditioned mind, which some of us, myself included, seem to battle continuously. And so some of the distinctions that you make that distinguish the epigenetic part and the part that's conditioned, and the part that I really got that distinction this time about the authentic self. So the authentic self is something that I think we all yearn to be part of, that we know is in us and we know we want access to, but we just can't find the doorway. So between you and your wonderful staff, you know, little tidbits that they give you. I mean, they're like these little breadcrumbs that come out of left field that you, you know, just go, oh, yeah. And it's really a wonderful way to take the time, the rare opportunity to actually spend time in the silence of yourself. And that was something that I really took away recently from something that you explained. And you always ask us, what did you learn? So we have to force our consciousness into the places to distinguish what did we learn and what didn't we learn. And then you reveal that to us in such a powerful way that, yes, when you go back to your existing life, the glaring distinctions that are clearly not workable, you're confronted with what has to change. And that's the takeaway, I think, that really makes a distinction so powerful and something that, you know, anybody should want to take the privilege to have that time for themselves to reach into the silence of who we are, which is rare between all of our, you know, devices that we're attached to. And, you know, we're in such a programmed way that we don't even realize that we're doing this. We don't realize that, oh my God, I'm distracting myself because I'm so used to doing that, that I, unless you keep pointing out that's not working. Why are you doing that? Oh, I am doing that again. Well, I'll be darned. I didn't really get in touch with what I was doing that wasn't working. And that continuous atmosphere, this environment that we step into for that moment, that penetrating time into a different way of being, gives us that opportunity. And, you know, it's a delight to be with the staff. It's a delight to be with like-minded people who really do want to make a change in their lives.
Kathleen, we're out of time. I just want to ask you to answer me real quick. Before you come down in the last 12 months, did you have 3 near-death experiences?
Yes, I did, which you predicted.
Mm-hmm. How do you feel now?
Well, I feel much more grounded. I feel much more capable to, I do eat pretty well. I'm not a junk food eater. I'm not that. But when you're in your space, the body takes on a whole different kind of tone. And that's what I feel right now, is an
good
inner strength that I really appreciate.
Kathleen, keep it up, all right? We'll see you at the next retreat. That's Kathleen. And by the way, Kathleen is an extraordinarily talented artist, and she was one of the important voices within the 1960s and 70s self-empowerment movements in the United States. We're going, and by the way, Luann's on the phone. Luann, if people would like to join us as a fundraiser, but also to help change their own life for WBAI, give us your number and that you're going to interview people to make sure this is right for them.
Surely. It's 903-881-7008. That's 903-881-7008. Give me a call, and I'll be happy to chat with you.
Okay, that's for the upcoming retreat, the only one this year. That's it. It's 1 week or two, the last week of April, the first week of May. Starts on a Sunday in a magnificently beautiful environment, serene, positive, uplifting, and the discussions. I might do 10 different discussions a day. They're all extemporaneous, but they all, as you heard, they help people get grounded and get real, and then go home and make the positive changes they need to. And Kathleen was there in no small measure because she also knew Tom Larson, and a couple people knew Tom, and realized, wow, Tom didn't make it this time from congestive heart failure. He could have. He was invited. But there's a whole lot of lessons to learn from other people who choose not to change, and what we can see in them that we can then apply to ourselves. And it got some people to wake up. That's unfortunate because I like Tom. He was a friend for 30 years. But once again, this year I've lost a lot of friends in the last 12 months. And none of them had to die. That's the darn part of it. Back in a moment with my guest. Please stay with us. I gave you his bio a little while ago. We're going out to Illinois right now and say hello to Professor Francis Boyle. Nice to have you with us again.
Well, thank you very much for having me on, Gary. My best to your listening audience.
And I just want to inform our satellite stations and syndicated stations, we're going to be going a little over today because of the time we just took as a fundraiser for our sister station. So far, most of the international community, except for the United States, Canada, and Israel, and most European nations, do not support the push to recognize the National Assembly, this one guy who is the supposed legitimate president, even though he wasn't voted president. Nevertheless, against the United Nations, the Organization of American States' opposition to unilateral sanctions and interference in other nations' affairs, the Trump administration is pushing ahead to remove President Maduro by any means necessary. In fact, Bolton, I believe, was quoted that he'd like to see him put into Guantanamo and then open it up for privatization of the oil. And the UN Human Rights Council has condemned these sanctions, and now McClatchy News Services reports that the ousting Maduro without violence is unlikely. He won't leave peacefully. So please provide your insights and analysis into Washington's actions to bring forth a coup in Venezuela that the American media supports, and like the New York Times and CNN. And are we witnessing in the Venezuela crisis any new precedents in the way the U.S. is conducting a regime change in a foreign government? And what is being done that would qualify the U.S. actions thus far as direct human rights violations? The form is yours.
Well, sure. I mean, obviously, this is all about stealing Venezuela's oil. They have the largest deposits of oil there in the entire world. And it's just like the regime change operation by Obama against Libya in order to steal their oil. And, you know, they're telling whatever lies, propaganda, disinformation they can. And the mainstream media is going along with it, as they always do, going back to Herman and Chomsky's manufacturing consent, when, you know, they document the mainstream news media fully supporting the war against Vietnam. And nothing has really changed. From a legal perspective, nothing could be clearer that the Trump-Canadian Lima Group policies towards Venezuela violate Article 19 of the Charter of the Organization of American States that prohibit any type of intervention into the affairs of Venezuela. The standard in the OAS, which we helped charter, which we helped draft, by the way, was deliberately intended to be a higher standard than the United Nations Charter on this matter, because we were supposed to be sister American republics and have a higher standard among ourselves. I document this in my book, Foundations of World Order. And the OAS Charter, this provision, and another provision as well, were specifically intended as the legal repudiation of the so-called Monroe Doctrine, and then the Roosevelt corollary to the Monroe Doctrine, using military force to enforce it. And there, Article 20 of the OAS Charter says, no state may use or encourage the use of coercive measures of an economic or political character to force the sovereign will of another state or obtain from it advantages of any kind. So clearly what the Trump administration is doing here is illegal under the OAS Charter. It's also illegal under the United Nations Charter. He has repeatedly threatened the use of military force publicly against Venezuela, and that violates Article 2, Paragraph 4 of the UN Charter, prohibiting the threat of force to change the politics of a nation. Likewise, in the very famous Nicaragua versus United States of America, the International Court of Justice went through all this already when the Reagan administration was making these arguments to justify its illegal war intervention, et cetera, against Nicaragua. And all these arguments made by the Reagan administration were rejected under customary international law with reference to both the UN Charter and the OAS Charter. And I notice, you know, Bolton used to work for Reagan. So, you know, he knows all about this. He's a sharp guy, went to Yale Law School. We're about the same age. So, you know, he knows what he's doing here is completely illegal. So we've been through all this before. You'll note Nicaragua has also been targeted for regime change and destabilization. And, you know, Bolton has his troika of tyranny. He's put Cuba back there. This is all predictable. I gave a speech here back in the fall of 2017, and I pointed out that after 9/11, 2001, the United States has been going all around the world to steal as much oil and gas as they can under whatever pretext they can come up with. And that Venezuela, Cuba, and I also said Ecuador were in their crosshairs. And that's why they reactivated the Fourth Fleet recently. Ecuador, you know, is now a new president that's accommodating the United States. Cuba doesn't really have any, you know, great natural assets except its people. I've been down there for a week. But, you know, we've been at war with Cuba since, you know, Castro. So nothing has changed there. So there we are. You know, it's clearly illegal, violates the OAS Charter, violates customary international laws interpreted by the World Court in the Nicaragua case, violates the UN Charter. But they think they can inflict regime change on Maduro and then get in there and steal all that oil. So that's really what this is all about, Gary.
If you can determine this by your research and your scholarship, why haven't the New York Times, Washington Post, CNN, the Boston Globe, and other papers who have equally capable resources come to the same conclusion? Instead, they're siding with this administration against Venezuela, and our government and Maduro opponents have been labeling Maduro a dictator and an enemy in danger to the global community. We've heard this before. However, Since when does a dictator have an oppositional leader as the head of the nation's parliamentary body? Now, granted, there were irregularities in the last election that Maduro unanimously won, and clearly there is corruption. It was a snap election. And yet this, how do you pronounce his name, Guaido? G-U-A-I-D-O?
Guaido?
Yeah.
Guaido. Right.
This Guaido guy was not even a running...
Right.
He was not even running cabinet.
He's our stooge and bootlicker. He was trained by the National Endowment for Humanities, NED, and USAID and all the rest of these people. So he's the person we picked to try to carry out regime change. It'd be like Nancy Pelosi saying, well, now I'm the president of the United States of America and everyone recognized me and let's depose Trump. I mean, I don't support Trump, but, you know, he was elected president and there he is. So the media has never changed, Gary. I've been, you know, opposing wars here in the United States since the Vietnam War, and the media always, you know, this is what Chomsky and Herman said. They're just a propaganda organ for the government. They're tied into it. They're part of it. So of course they're not going to challenge any of this. Working with Institute for Public Accuracy, we put out a press release last week on all this to 8,000 media sources all over the country. None of them have contacted me. I haven't seen Noam Chomsky on there. I haven't seen Ramsey Clark on there. But that's always been the case. There's nothing unusual about it at all. And that's why I would say, they're pretty much fake media between you and me. They're just warmongers, warmongering. This is what they've done, at least in my political lifetime, going back to the Vietnam War. So nothing's changed here. NPR, National Propaganda Radio, the propaganda broadcasting system, you can just go through the list. But it's always that way.
My final question is that some are arguing that the United States is conducting a plan to reshape Latin America in its image. In recent years, there's been a dramatic shift towards the extreme right in Latin America. One analysis called it the Trumpification of Latin America. We find demagogues such as Bolsonaro in Brazil, and Macri in Argentina, and Pinera in Chile. They all are elected in the last couple of years, and yet they're all puppets of the United States. And I'm not seeing the people in Congress saying, what are we doing with our 69th regime change? When are we going to stop this nonsense?
Right. Well, please tell me how many members of Congress have opposed our wars against Afghanistan or Iraq or Libya or Syria. The list goes on, going back to the Tonkin Gulf Resolution in 1964. So there we are. It's really up to us, the American people here, to try to do something about this. And demonstrate our opposition. Otherwise, I haven't read the McClatchy report you're referring to, but if we continue down this path, you could see military conflict breaking out there in Venezuela along the lines of what happened in Libya and Syria and Iraq as a result of our regime change operations there and large numbers of people getting killed. But understand, that doesn't matter to Trump and Bolton, Elliot Abrams. We all know Elliot Abrams from the Reagan wars against Central America. He and I were classmates together at Harvard Law School. Abrams was responsible for murdering 35,000 people in Nicaragua, 75,000 in El Salvador, and 200,000 or more in Guatemala, most of whom were Mayan Indians. That's outright genocide. And he's the point man now on Venezuela. So, this man is thoroughly ruthless, unprincipled, and a genocider. So they don't really care how many Venezuelans they have to kill. They just want that oil. It's just like Libya. We didn't care. You know, Obama went in there and exterminated 50,000 Libyans. No one really cared about that. It's the oil. Likewise, Iraq. At least Trump is honest about Iraq, unlike all of his predecessors, saying, yeah, we're here for the oil. So there it is, Gary.
I appreciate, once again, all of your commitments, more than a 50-year commitment to challenging imperialism, hegemony around the world. And your new book, I want to mention to people, is called Poems Against Empire, which captures his half-century of reflections during his career on the forefront of fighting for peace, justice, and human rights and international law. Thank you very much, Professor Francis Boyle, for being on today.
Thanks a lot, Gary. My best to you and your listening audience.
Okay, we're out of time, everyone. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.